The first few years with Peggy were marvelous, but then her arteries began to harden, and it was awful. I'd come in late at night and navigate around the artwork, through the Calder, past the Giacometti matchstick people, whose arms got broken all the time, but not by me, then turn right, dodging the Pevsner, and into the bedroom. I was with her when she had her first heart attack, and her face went all funny. After that, Peggy kept a 15-pound cowbell by her bed, and I'd leave my door open with the understanding that if she clanged, I would leap up and run to her assistance. It was a 24-hour-a-day job. I liked Jane and Philip, Hones Bean went on. We spent hours together, and Jane's a terribly good cook. They had won Peggy over, too. It was the frozen corn on the cob that did it. Jane brought it from the PX in Aviano, and it went straight to Peggy's heart. But people kept telling me, watch out for Jane Rylance. Who told you that? I asked. Oh, everybody. And then Jane and Philip began to invite Peggy to dinner and not invite me. They wouldn't say anything about it to me. They'd sneak her out. Peggy was a semi-invalid by then, so it would have been a huge effort for them to pick her up, take her out, and bring her back. Peggy was hard work, and not many people would put up with her. The mischief went on behind my back during the summer. It clicked into high gear when I left in November and continued until I returned in the spring. By the time Peggy reached her final illness in the fall of 1979, Philip and Jane Rylance had become her virtual keepers. They had keys to her house. They looked after her affairs. They took her to the hospital in Padua. The day after Peggy died, the director of the Guggenheim Museum in New York, Thomas Messer, arrived in Venice to take possession of the premises. He found Philip Rylance in the flooded basement, moving paintings to keep them from getting wet. Needing someone on hand to carry out the orders of the New York office, Messer asked Philip to act as temporary supervisor. Later, he appointed Philip permanent administrator. The rise of the Rylances had begun. It was clear from the start that Jane Rylance intended to have a role in the running of the museum, to the irritation of Messer. On one occasion, Messer told me, I was giving instructions to Philip in Jane's presence on some probably minor procedural matter, and she blurted out, "No, that cannot be done." I thought she really had a nerve interfering like that. I became very angry and let her know she was not to consider herself part of the management of the museum. But she dug her heels in and went right on exercising authority that no one had given her. She dominated Philip. I thought he was the most henpecked husband I ever saw. Once the Rylances had their Guggenheim bona fides firmly in hand, Jane leveraged her position in ways that could only be called brilliant. She took over a lecture series at the Gritti and invited such luminaries as Stephen Spender, Arthur Schlesinger, Peter Quinnell, John Julius Norwich, Brendan Gill, Adolph Green, Hugh Casson, and Frank Giles, editor of the Sunday Times of London. She gave dinner parties, and among the people signing her guestbook were the speakers at the Gritti, and such others as Adnan Khashoggi, Jean Kirkpatrick, and Queen Alexandra of Yugoslavia. When I looked at her guestbook, said Helen Sheehan, an intern at the Guggenheim in the 1980s, I realized Jane was putting a lot of energy into making a social life for herself. She used to tell me, one moves forward in society.